everybody, welcome to the podcast. This is Aaron. Thanks for joining. And I have two really exciting guests here with us, Stacia and Lauren. Say hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. Both of, and you guys can specify what your fields are, but I've got a couple capable mental health professionals here with me as we're in this series talking about spirituality and mental health and how they interact. And so, Stacia, you've been on the podcast once before. So since you've done this before, we'll make you go first.
Awesome.
Give us a little bit of a bio. Tell us about you.
Sure. I'm Stacia Chaplin. I am an LCSW. That's a licensed clinical social worker. Currently, I am in private practice with some other girls at Full Circle Counseling. And my preference is trauma work, but we kind of work with everything across the board. So I'm super excited to be here today to talk about trauma.
Yeah. Trauma is our focus for the day. Yeah. And then also, you've helped integrated wellness get up and going, which we've talked about here on the podcast before.
Absolutely.
And people,
that's true. We don't want to forget about integrated wellness.
Yeah. Maybe familiar with that as well.
Yeah.
Cool.
Absolutely.
Lauren?
My name's Lauren Fugit. I'm an LPC, so licensed professional counselor. I've been licensed too long. Hard to admit that. 2010. Wow. And I've had a lot of different roles. Currently, I'm the clinical director of an intensive outpatient program called the Middle Path here in Blount County. And I'm also in private practice. I've worked from nonprofit mental health agencies to inpatient hospitals. I've done a lot of trauma work as well. I primarily worked with kids with trauma histories. But right now I see clients with various issues from trauma to major depression, anxiety, a lot of things.
Yeah. So you guys both ended up mental health professionals. How did you end up landing in this field?
Well, one day I woke up. I'm just kidding. This is Stacia. I think for me, I actually started out in the health field. I have two older brothers. Both of them are physicians. And so I was going to go that route as I am the youngest. But, you know, the more time that I spent in the medical field, I just always felt like something was missing. You know, I will never forget, I was shadowing a doctor in a volunteer community clinic kind of a thing. And the patient was telling this doctor how he was struggling with alcohol. And this doctor, and this is not to talk badly about physicians by any means, but in this one instance, you know, this physician was just kind of like poo-pooing it, you know, and the physician kept saying, well, all you got to do is stop drinking and your blood pressure will go down.
Just make a choice.
Yeah. And then just walked out of the room and this guy was in tears. And I remember thinking, wow, there's so much more that I want to do than be able, you know, than just to do the medical part. And that's needed too. I mean, I want to, you know, appreciate that and give light to that. But that's kind of what got me started in this direction of noticing that there's more.
So here's an honest question from my own ignorance. Is it offensive if you make a distinction between hard and soft sciences? Like, because people sometimes will talk about mental health professionals like, oh, they're kind of more on the soft sciences. Does that ruffle your feathers?
It depends on who it is. I personally am not, but I know people that would be.
Yeah, I get it. I get it. Because the reason why I said that is, and I've said that before, like, I prefer my sciences soft. Like, really hyper-technical, like, oh no, I can't possibly. But the more sort of theoretical, let's figure out how we work, I think that's really fascinating, which is maybe why we're doing this. What about you, Lauren? How'd you end up a mental health professional?
Well, it definitely wasn't because of my first experience in mental health, because that was not positive. It was actually, I remember it was having to go through counseling while my parents were going through a divorce.
Oh, yeah.
And we were mandated to go through, and it was a horrible experience.
Oh.
But it wasn't really until later. I was actually in high school and doing a senior transition class, and part of it was like exploring different careers and things like that. And I did like a job shadow actually at Blount Memorial in their inpatient unit, and I got to tour around and I was like, this is fascinating. It was really interesting and kind of piqued my interest there. And then just through kind of studying psychology in my undergrad and all that, I was like, I love it. This is it. I didn't know where it would take me at that point, but I knew I had to do something in that field.
Yeah.
It's a very broad field. There's a lot of different places you can go. And so I was the same way of like, I don't really know where this is going to get me, but one thing leads to the other.
Yeah. It's been a great experience. We're going to spend some time chatting about trauma in particular. And here's the thing, like, it seems like a really broad subject, and the term to me feels really, really vague. And if we were to go, you know, I don't know exactly how you find it, but sometimes you'll do a word search on Google and they will, it'll show you a graph of how frequently a word has been used throughout history. I haven't looked at it for the word trauma, but I'm betting we're in like this massive spike where it's like, I used to never hear this word and now everybody's traumatized all the time. Mm-hmm. And I was like, probably that's moving into reality and probably it swung way past reality. Mm-hmm. I have no sense of that, but it's pretty buzzy right now.
Absolutely.
And I do hear people, myself included, using the word trauma and be like, we don't really know what that word means. So I think we have to start there. What do you guys have an operating definition, or how would you go about defining trauma?
So I consider trauma any stressful event or disturbing event that causes adverse physical responses in your body for a lengthy amount of time. Mm-hmm. So there's various types of trauma, which, you know, we can get into that. But essentially, you're looking at the outcome of what that experience was. Mm-hmm. And trauma is different for everybody. So I always say, you know, to clients that I work with, I could be in the same car accident as you. Mm-hmm. You might walk out with trauma. I might walk out feeling just fine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's very different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, okay, so my experience of that is like, sometimes people experience something or in a shared experience of something, one person might be horrifically traumatized, the other one not so much. Mm-hmm. And then we think, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but we might tend to think, okay, the one who walked away unscathed is the strong one, the other one the weak. But then those same people could experience a different kind of trauma and then it'd be flipped. The one who was unaffected by the car accident, for example, is just traumatized horrifically by, I don't know, an embarrassing moment or whatever, or a shameful moment.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So it's not a strong and weak thing based on how you react.
Not at all. Not at all. And we talk about, you know, the different kinds of trauma. You know, there's acute trauma. And, you know, according to the DSM, that's, you know, when we have that, those adverse reactions to the negative event lasting less than a month or up to a month. And then we go into, you know, the bigger diagnoses, which is, you know, the post-traumatic stress disorder. And that's, you know, those adverse reactions lasting longer than a month. So there's really that difference. But then, you know, then we also have our micro traumas, which you talked about too. And that's a whole other ballgame.
Yes.
So trauma, I mean, it's all about these negative events, but there's various forms of it.
Okay. I probably have too many questions about all of those things, but maybe we'll get to some of those distinctions. We'll see how far we get.
Absolutely.
Lauren, does that definition settle okay with you?
I like that. And ever since I've heard it called little T and big T, I've gravitated towards that.
Okay,
and that
so explain it's, that.
It's trauma, but depending on how intense that reaction is, we're looking at a little T trauma or a big T trauma. Okay. And so the longer the duration of those reactions to that event, that's playing into that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and you've got to be careful not to look at it from that judgmental place of kind of like what you were saying of, I don't see why that would be such a big deal or such a problem. It's really about an individual's experience and how they're perceiving something. I do a lot of assessments in my job, and when I'm asking about trauma, I give some examples because some people don't really know what that means. And they'll start telling me about losing a dog. And that has lingered with them for years after the fact. And then they start sobbing. And you can tell that was actually a traumatic event for them. Yeah. Whereas somebody else may see it as, you've lost a pet. That's not that big of a deal.
Yeah. And how they react to that experience could also be, or would be, mm-hmm. strongly informed by previous experiences of loss, mm-hmm. right? So mm-hmm. it's not those events, I guess, wouldn't be isolated. They're not standalone events. The mm-hmm. way you process mm-hmm. what you're facing has a lot to do with what lies in your background and
yeah.
things that you probably can and cannot remember. Mm-hmm. And so it's, if you try to work backwards and place a judgment on something, yeah. You're probably in dangerous territory. Okay, but yeah. I do, and this is pure confession here, guys. You could just say, well, Aaron, that's wrong. I find myself rolling the eyes of my heart sometimes when somebody was like, oh, I lost my keys and that was traumatic, and I stubbed my toe and that right. was traumatic, and my wife said something and she seemed a little grumpy and that was mm-hmm. traumatic. And I was like, okay, how do we draw a distinction between a bad mood, a mm-hmm. bad day, a bad experience versus yeah. something? And it sounds like what I'm hearing is the distinction is how it affects you moving forward.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. How the adverse response to that impacts your ability to function. Mm-hmm. So you think about, you know, the classic symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. You know, you think of the soldier that comes home from war, you know, and 4th of July, the fireworks are going off mm-hmm. and that's, you know, triggering a flashback, nightmares, mm-hmm. Disturbance mm-hmm. in mood, irritability,
hypervigilance.
Mm-hmm. Oh my goodness. Yeah. Just, I mean, the list can go on. But once again, like, those adverse reactions are different between, you know, the big T and the mm-hmm. little T. So, you know, when I'm doing trauma work with somebody, and actually with every client, whether they come in with an identified big trauma, we're actually doing a lot of developmental education mm-hmm. on what appropriate development looks like for a child, because trauma starts day one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's actually a newer, you know, psychology, and I'm not very familiar with it, but it was coming out when I was still in school, of that prenatal trauma mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. of us, our bodies being able to, you know, remember trauma that's happened to us prenatally.
Yeah. So epigenetics, the mm-hmm. idea that, some of not your DNA, but I'm going to knock little markers get tagged onto your DNA and they get passed back, and it can go back 3 and 4 generations, mm-hmm. right?
Absolutely.
Interesting.
It's amazing. It's very interesting.
There's a verse in the Bible about the sins of the father being passed down mm-hmm. to 3rd and 4th generation and things like that.
What?
And I don't think that's completely out of nowhere.
Yep.
So that's like that. Okay. Yeah. So, okay. What about this then? The phrase is, I hear micro trauma floating mm-hmm. around. I've like never heard that. And then suddenly I've heard it. Mm-hmm. Is that a thing? Is that a valid distinction? What would you say about that?
You touched on, you feel free. I know you touched on it earlier, okay. but yes. yeah, so, go ahead.
So micro traumas are these little traumas that happen throughout our life. They mm-hmm. can be, you know, being put down by, you know, another child on the playground. Mm-hmm. They can be experiences of sudden abandonment, mm-hmm. which, you know, today we have the term ghosting. Mm-hmm. You know, so these things are happening to us, you know, all of us on a regular basis. Somebody cutting mm-hmm. us off, you know, cutting in front of us in line at Starbucks or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, all of these little things. And so these individual events don't necessarily cause an adverse reaction, but when they're happening over and over in your life, they begin to help formulate these beliefs about mm-hmm. self.
Okay.
So if you think of, you know, the child on the playground who maybe doesn't have the greatest support system at home, kind of, you know, lonely, you know, on the playground, other children are putting them down. That's mm-hmm. reinforcing this belief that there's something wrong with that child. Mm-hmm. So the child would think, okay, there must be something wrong with me. And every time they would get this response from the environment of, you know, being pushed away or mm-hmm. abandoned, it's reinforcing that belief, there's something wrong with mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. And so that is actually, I do a lot mm-hmm. of that work of addressing yeah. those micro traumas.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they're not standalone events. Again, they're
right. Repetitive.
They, yeah. Mm-hmm. So that might hit, again, it might strike one child as traumatic. Mm-hmm. Another kid is, they might laugh it off and think nothing of it.
Absolutely.
And it's informed by what's in the background. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. They're building that sense of self around all of those experiences. Mm-hmm. And so that's where you see a lot of adults who have really low self-esteem or, you know, really struggle with feelings of abandonment. And it's a result of this, mm-hmm. you know, this building of all these experiences over time.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about just application for people who are listening. One of my experiences when people are trying to evaluate, do I need to get help? Do I need to get some prayer? Do I need to see a therapist, etc.? And what I hear a lot is saying, what I went through, fill in the blank, doesn't seem like it's that traumatic, mm-hmm. or it doesn't seem like the type of thing that should mean that I need to get help. Mm-hmm. And really, the type of thing that it was is almost irrelevant. That's what I'm hearing you say. It's really about what matters is how you're reacting to it, mm-hmm. how you've been affected by it. And that's not a strong or weak calculation.
Absolutely.
It's just, is it affecting your reality and the way you move out into the world? And if so, then maybe you can get some help, and that mm-hmm. would be helpful.
And then you think about it too, you know, it's not only how does it impact the individual person that has experienced the trauma, big T or little t, the family system around that person is going to be impacted as well. The friendships mm-hmm. around that person are going to be impacted. Mm-hmm. So, you know, then it's kind of like that ripple effect, you know, and then we talk about generational trauma, you know, mm-hmm. that's kind of along those same lines of like, you know, even though something doesn't happen directly to a person, they can still have, you know, that impact or that experience of an adverse reaction from a trauma that was somebody else's trauma.
Right. Yeah. And if those ripples then extend into your family or to your family unit, well, some family units are really strong and those mm-hmm. ripples might not mean much. And then others, it could cause a chain reaction and be really, really problematic. Mm-hmm. And then you're going, well, now we've got this huge mess and it doesn't feel like that big of a thing. And maybe I don't need help, but then maybe you do. Mm-hmm. So what about acute versus chronic trauma? How would you draw a distinction there? I can't just tell you what's happening. I'm just giving you guys words that I've heard and I don't know what they mean. So I've heard acute, I've heard chronic. How would we distinguish?
Yeah, I think you're going back to a severity or an intensity level as far as, you know, how much this is impacting you at that time in that moment versus this is something I'm dealing with over a very long period of time. Mm-hmm. And so you gave the example of the vet earlier and having the response. Is it just during the 4th of July that they have that kind of reaction? Yes. Is that PTSD still relevant and valid? And every 4th of July, we have that reaction, and that's a stressor. Mm-hmm. Or is this something every day there's some sort of constant trigger or stressor to that's triggering these reactions and responses mm-hmm. to that? So it's really looking at how a person is experiencing it and how much it's impacting their functioning.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Acute is seen more as like, you know, you have one major event that has lasting impact. Mm-hmm. The chronic is like you're living in a home with an abusive family member. So this is ongoing, chronic, everyday mm-hmm. abuse.
Got it. Yeah, that helps. You know, this isn't about me, but if I try to put a personal lens on it, I have had things happen to me where people will go, oh, that must have been a traumatic event, like an acute trauma. How were you impacted mm-hmm. by that? And I've had to go, no, like I didn't change a thing. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's just part of my wiring, but I went through a 2-year period that just sucked. Nothing worked. It was hard. It was exhausting. I was frustrated. Mm-hmm. And while I haven't noticed, like, because what I'm getting for your definition of trauma is really how and to what degree it changes the way you live your life. Mm-hmm. And I've had acute events mm-hmm. that didn't change a thing. But at the end of that, like, 2-year period, I had to look back and go, oh, I'm different now. Mm-hmm. I behave differently. I respond mm-hmm. to things differently. Things trigger me or like freak me out in a way that they never did before. Mm-hmm. And it like took years to sort of move out of that. And that was a shift for me because I tend to think one big event that equals trauma mm-hmm. as opposed to sustained, just difficult circumstances mm-hmm. and that shift in the way you.
I do want to chime in and I do want to talk about like the diagnostic part of it. You know, like the intent of this is not for people to be self-diagnosing. You know, mm-hmm. we talked about the difference between that acute stress response and the PTSD, you know, to actually have a diagnosis of PTSD, there's several things that you mm-hmm. have to hit. It's not just having nightmares or just having flashbacks. It's pretty major. And so mm-hmm. I by no means want people to.
I've heard a lot of people self-diagnose.
That's scary.
That's
scary because, I mean, it takes away from when it's real. I mean, there's multiple reasons mm-hmm. why that's kind of a scary thing. So this is not to self-diagnose. I mean, we all essentially experience trauma and some mm-hmm. of us, you know, experience heavier trauma than others. And basically, you know, don't worry about the diagnosis. That part does not matter. The part that does matter is that if you are having these adverse, you know, reactions to stress where it's impacting your ability to live and function, mm-hmm. then that's whenever you should be calling somebody else to help you out.
Yeah, that's a really good distinction mm-hmm. to make. Mm-hmm. I think it's important. It's not like it's such a bad thing to say, oh, I feel traumatized by this, or to say, I have PTSD. I've heard a lot of people say, I have PTSD. And I was like, I don't think you've ever seen a professional mm-hmm. ever. Like, I don't know the whole story, but, and maybe that's not that big a deal. But then I think of people just in my own circle and in the life of our church who have really, like, their entire lives are dramatically mm-hmm. reordered around the fact that they're dealing with a post-traumatic stress disorder. Mm-hmm. And it feels flippant and dismissive to what they're experiencing to say, oh, I have PTSD because, and you just say that mm-hmm. conversationally as if mm-hmm. as if it's not that big mm-hmm. a deal.
Your trauma is not as big as mine. I mean, that mm-hmm. doesn't feel good to compare. So
yeah,
absolutely.
For yeah. sure.
It's something that I have people come up with all the time. Social media has been a big influence of that self-diagnosis, and mm-hmm. and so they have put that on themselves, and then they go around talking about that diagnosis and how that meets them. And I get a lot of clients that come in and they don't feel validated. They don't feel heard or understood because nobody really takes what they're going through seriously.
Mm.
Yeah. Or, oh man, if that's PTSD, then what am I experiencing that's mm-hmm. so much worse? Does that mean that I'm actually broken?
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah.
And how are they handling that so much better than I am?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
A lot of comparison goes in there, and that's not fair. That's not fair for them, yeah. you know, to see this other person. And, well, if they have that diagnosis, how are they handling that so much better than I am? Well, they may not actually have that diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but we kind of assume or we mm-hmm. label. So I think I saw a little glimmer in your eye about social media.
Oh,
okay. Say words about that.
Can we Lauren. Burn it? Can we it's burn it to place. The ground? Like, it's just let place. It go, let Lauren. It go.
Go
I just
Lauren.
Oh gosh, the soapbox. I can get on. Be very cautious about what you see on social media. Mm-hmm. That would be the big picture thing I would say. There's a lot of misinformation. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people with reasons for spreading information that I don't know that they maybe have.
You're being so careful right
golly,
now.
Golly, this is hard. The kindest of intentions behind uh-huh. what they're doing, it can be incredibly confusing and overwhelming and misguided and misleading. And I really can't tell you the amount of harm that some of the social media has done to people, creating trauma, but yeah. also just overwhelming them even further and trying to figure out, they go there to try and figure out what they're going through and what they're mm-hmm. dealing with. And they're just getting a lot of information that's not very helpful.
Yeah. I mean, if you're encouraging somebody to self-diagnose, that's already, that's kind of dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to, that's going to get particular traction with people who are struggling in mm-hmm. general. So you're already dealing with maybe the more vulnerable people who are mm-hmm. going to be drawn to something that is encouraging you to self-diagnose. And then once you've got someone who's put a label on themselves that may or may not be correct,
mm-hmm.
now they're in perfect position for you to then manipulate mm-hmm. and control and coerce in all sorts of ways.
Mm-hmm.
And that all sounds really grimy to me. Scary. So be careful, be mindful of what your kids might be.
Kids, I would say adults too. I mean, mm-hmm. I get a lot of adults
yeah.
too. I don't, yes, absolutely kids. But I do, I see a lot of adults that have gone there too. And the other thing that I've seen that I feel like has been kind of trendy lately too is almost coaching people on how to have a certain diagnosis.
Yeah.
And so kind of going back to that invalidating and demeaning where somebody is actually going through that.
Versus someone who's maybe doing some attention seeking. And,
right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just be very, very careful.
My stomach just churns talking about it. That's all very icky.
It's not about the label, man.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's not about the label.
It's not.
So be mindful. That was a worthwhile
I'm like, that was
sidebar.
A lot to say, be mindful.
And I'm just going to throw it out here. I think I put this about every other podcast. You don't, it's actually optional to be on social media. There's no law.
Total choice.
You don't have to.
Nope. Unless your grandmother wants to see pictures of your children.
Yes, that's right.
Then it is not a choice.
And there are many wonderful gratifying things about social media, but you know,
just saying, there's email, y'all. There's email. Yeah, there's there text messages.
That's true.
I mean,
you just called me out.
We survived without it.
Like when I get started on social media, I'm like, nope, just end it.
So let's continue down the path of Aaron saying words he doesn't really know what they mean, and then you guys sort of clearing the forest for me a little bit. Who wants to take a shot at talking about how the autonomic nervous system works? Because I think it, from what little tiny drop I know, I think it goes a long way to help us understand how our bodies react to life in general. Who wants to go for it?
Yeah,
Lauren.
Go for it. Okay. So our
there we go.
Yeah. We'll take
here
it.
We go.
Here we go.
Say she's going
to
so batter up.
This is normally whenever I get out my whiteboard. So we're going to try to do this without drawing pictures.
Okay.
So bear with me. So our autonomic nervous system is our natural, it's this subconscious response that our body has. So this is what regulates things like our breathing, our heart rate, our muscle movements, all of that good stuff. So these are things we do not necessarily have conscious thought or control over. Mm-hmm. That is also how we respond to threats.
Yeah.
Is this autonomic nervous system. And so we have the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous system within that. So
let me just hit pause. The autonomic nervous system is the way our body reacts to things, and these are things that kind of work on autopilot a little bit.
Correct.
We don't always inform.
Mm-hmm.
Like our digestion, for example. I'm not telling my heart to beat or my food to digest. It's just happening.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And so we don't always dictate it. So if, for example, there was a loud bang that was startling, it would create a whole bunch of cascading effects in your body, and none of that would be something you were consciously telling your body to do.
Yeah.
Correct.
That's a type of stuff the autonomic nervous system does.
Absolutely.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And so within that, we have our sympathetic and the parasympathetic. Mm-hmm. And the sympathetic is that fight or flight response. So you just gave the example of, you know, a loud bang and that startle response.
Mm-hmm.
Our first go-to is within that sympathetic. And that's either fight whatever it is in front of us or run. And when that is not an option, our body will actually go down more towards the parasympathetic, and that goes into freeze.
Mm-hmm.
And then that other word that we have identified as fawn.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So the freeze or fawn. So those usually will come after fight or flight is identified as not being an option.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Okay. So I'm going to pause again on terms. The word sympathetic's not very helpful because we think of sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
And then that's not the correct. I mean, that word makes me think of something different than what you're describing, word sympathy.
Absolutely.
So, okay. So just for those who are listening, don't get caught up with, am I showing sympathy for someone? That's not what we're talking about.
No.
We're talking about how we react to a moment.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah. I don't know where the origin of that word comes from.
Yeah, but doesn't matter.
We just know that it happens. And so we have that fight or flight response. And when that's not an option, such as if we are a small child living in an abusive home, for example, we're not going to fight.
Yep.
You know, our very large parent, and we cannot run.
Nowhere to go.
Because we have nowhere to go. Then we go to the freeze, which, you know, you think of the animal playing dead. That's freeze. So, you know, that can be seen as like avoidance. That can be seen as like falling asleep. Those kinds of behaviors. And then the fawn behavior. And that is actually
Never heard that one. I've heard the other
newer.
Three.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's newer. And so fawn is identified as, how do I put this into actual words here? You are playing into the relationship so that you are less likely to be a threat to the abuser.
Mm-hmm.
So you are going to be the yes man. You're going to agree with whatever it is that they're asking for. You're going to
play along.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Looking for the term of I'm trying to think of the name of that behavior and it's not coming to my head.
I don't know either.
Okay.
I gotcha.
Anyway.
Way to call me out too. Like I'm like, oh dang, now I can't think of it either.
What's the word? You're essentially gonna be the yes man.
Yeah. You're saving yourself. You're okay, let's do what needs to be done. Okay. We got it.
I'm gonna roll with the punches. I'm not gonna create any ripples.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's That's fawn.
That's fawn.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so fight or flight, I think those are the most familiar terms. Mm-hmm. And fight or flight is not, you don't get to decide whether, how you respond, fight or flight. It just happens. Right. Is that also true for freeze and fawn? Or is it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just kind of a reaction. It's mm-hmm. just a response.
I mean, this is all the autonomic nervous system. Mm-hmm. So essentially you don't have a choice in any of this. This is all mm-hmm. a subconscious thing that happens. And so it's important, you know, if you are doing work with this area and experiencing these things, the important part is being able to identify which one of these am I using.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Because so is my behavior being able to identify I'm doing fight, flight, freeze, and fawn.
Correct.
And then out of that, you can, what does that then basically get your conscious mind to sort of take over mm-hmm. and control Absolutely. And then be able, that way you can actually dictate your choices.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. To some degree. However, that being said, depending on the amount of trauma that you have, and this may get really confusing, mm-hmm. but you're going to, this goes into
it's
the
so
brain.
Much.
I know there's so much. This goes into your brain. And so we, you know, these responses that we're identifying, these autonomic responses are actually part of what we identify. This is not the technical word, as the reptilian brain.
Yeah.
In the reptilian brain, the entire job of this core center part of your brain is to keep you alive.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Period. Mm-hmm. It is survival brain. Mm-hmm. And so what you're talking about, being able to be aware of these things, is actually the prefrontal cortex. Mm-hmm. It's the outer layers of your brain. Once again, I'm used to having these pictures to describe these things, but it's the newer brain essentially. Mm-hmm. And that's where things like decision making, imagination mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. comes from, that area of the brain, being able to problem solve. Mm-hmm. So if you've experienced this, you know, these major traumas, and you're stuck in that sympathetic nervous system all the time. If we have this chronic trauma and we're stuck mm-hmm. in this all the time, mm-hmm. our ability to problem solve goes out the window.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it just depends on the level of trauma that we're dealing with. Some people can talk themselves through it. Some people need to learn regulation skills before they can mm-hmm. be able to get into that parasympathetic.
So if you kind of get, I'm going to use, all these terms will be wrong, but I'm just trying to make it accessible for the layperson. If you're kind of in sort of the deeper resources of your brain mm-hmm. where you're responding subconsciously, mm-hmm. or it's probably not the right terminology to use, but can you get outside of that and then use your more logical mm-hmm. reasoning brain to inform? But if there's like a lot of trauma, or you're just kind of in a really tough spot, you may not actually be able to kick out of that reactionary part of your brain mm-hmm. and into the logical part of your brain.
Correct.
Is that right?
Yeah, that is correct. Yeah. And so what we would do in therapy is actually teach those regulation mm-hmm. skills. And so that's considered the bottom-up approach.
Okay.
Where we're actually working from the center of the brain and regulating that center of the brain so that mm-hmm. you can access mm-hmm. the higher part of mm-hmm. your brain. If we are coming from just talk therapy and we're like, we're just going to process the trauma and talk about mm-hmm. it and try to make sense of it in your life, that's the top-down approach. So mm-hmm. that's being able to use the logic to connect with
mm-hmm.
the reptilian brain.
So it's using, so you're talking about using sort of those deeper recesses of your brain to, it's working from the inside out versus the outside mm-hmm. in.
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. And so those are two different methods.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if you're in survival mode, you're not processing. Mm-hmm. You've got to get to a safe place to do that. So that's where those skills come in, to get you out of crisis mode, to get you out of survival mode, so that you can then.
So is it fair to say, if someone's having, again, probably not the right terminology, but what we would think of as a panic attack, okay, mm-hmm. they're hyperventilating, their heart rate's through the roof, they're, you know, the world is feeling mm-hmm. very, very small, and they're terrified. Mm-hmm. You're actually physically incapable of of high level processing and working your way logically through that.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
So you have to work to get yourself out of that state. Is that what you're talking about? How through therapy you help mm-hmm. people regulate?
Don't
their
solve
way
a problem
out of it.
In a panic attack. Yes. It's not going to go well.
Yeah, you can't.
It's You can't do that.
Yep. You also cannot think about other people. And that's that's something, you know, when we're doing crisis trainings, that's what we will learn, is that there's no problem solving if you're in crisis, because you don't have that ability to access that part of the brain. And so that when you're dealing with somebody in crisis, the entire goal of that moment is to get them out of crisis, not necessarily the physical part, but getting their brain to settle down, to regulate back into the parasympathetic.
Yeah.
And so those are things like, you know, breathing techniques, meditation, body scans, which is a type of, you know, meditation, even, you know, simple things like coloring, going for a walk. All of those things are going to help regulate your body to be able to access that higher thinking.
So if you feel yourself getting stuck in those moments where you feel those, again, maybe I didn't give the right list, but your stress is through the roof, your heart's racing, elevated breathing is that type of thing. You feel yourself getting stuck in those for whatever reason. That maybe is a sign that you could really benefit from some therapy where someone can give you some tools to help you not get stuck in that.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So I've heard this described alertness or like hypervigilance on one extreme versus being very calm on the other. And it's like a seesaw that goes one way or the other. You're kind of in a more calm state or a more vigilant state. And there's shades of each, right? But some people will just like you've got like a seesaw might get stuck. You can get stuck in a hypervigilant state. Or in a very calm, or almost, I guess that would be more of a depressive state. And then when people find themselves stuck, they can't always just will themselves out of it. Is that fair to say?
That's very fair.
Yeah. And then there are some people, it feels like the regulator between their... I see a lot of people get stuck, especially in like a hyper-vigilant state. So they're just always on alert and anxious. And then some people cycle back and forth from one extreme to the next. It's almost like whatever it is that regulates that seesaw, how loosely that seesaw goes from back and forth, that can get broken, or it can get it can get stuck. And is therapy is one of the ways that you can get unstuck. Is that is that too much of an oversimplification?
So Aaron had earlier, before we had started the podcast, or Aaron was talking about his dog. Tell the story about your dog. What did you notice about your dog?
Okay, my dog is Tyson. He's just adorable. I love him. My wife loves him so much more. great little dog, and he will just be completely out of, like, gone to the world, sound asleep in the most ridiculous poses. I don't know if you ever watch your dog sleep, but he gets in the most ridiculous spots, and he's gone. But then one sound... You know, the UPS man's not his favorite. He hears that truck, or he hears a school bus or whatever. He pops up out of that and then almost instantly enters the state where he is at the window, hypervigilant, every muscle in his body tense, and he is so alert to whatever that threat he feels. Now, if I ever get to that, if I get the state that he just cycled into, it's going to be like hours before I feel normal again. But he'll do that so often. I work right next to the window where he loves to come bark at whatever it is, right? And I'll just look over 3 minutes later and he's sound asleep on the couch again, whereas for me it would have taken hours.
Yes.
It's like he cycles in and out of those states, like, with there's just like no friction, whereas I don't feel that way at all.
So the difference between you and your dog is that your dog is in the moment, every moment. Your dog does not have the ability to think about what happened yesterday, what might happen tomorrow, what death might be like. I mean, your dog is the perfect example of how to stay mindful and in the moment every day. That's how your dog can cycle so quickly. So us as humans... I mean, we worry. We're worriers. So we're thinking about, oh my gosh, what happened yesterday? What's going to happen tomorrow? What are people going to think of me? Well, the last time I had to do this, this was the result. This might happen again. That's why, because we're not staying in the present moment. So, you know, some of those other skills, you know, that meditation, the deep breathing, the other part of that is learning mindfulness, learning how to bring yourself to the present moment and recognizing that in this moment, you are not being chased by a bear. In this moment, you are sitting on the couch. You are in, you know, our office, if we're in the office setting. And right now, you're loved. And then we identify who loves you right now. And we talk about those things. So it's bringing yourself into that present moment.
So to go back to an illustration I've used a few times while preaching, that's when I get in my time machine. When I jokingly talk about my, that only goes forward and at regular speed, where I just go, no, I'm here. I'm in this moment. I'm not in the future. I'm not in the past, in the present, and getting aware. Yeah.
Absolutely.
And some people, I think, find that really difficult to do. And others seem to do that much more easily. Like the difference between my dog and I. My dog, who apparently has a much greater state of mental health than I do.
Aren't you jealous? I'm jealous of that sometimes.
Me being jealous of my dog is actually a thing in our home. Whenever I'm really stressed out, Sharon knows, because I'll look at the dog and I'll be like, that dog has like a perfect life. He doesn't have to do anything. Everything's taken care of for him. There's no, everything's provided for him. And Sharon's like, you need a nap. Like, because I'm like, because I'm contrasting. It's like, I got to take care of all this stuff and I'm responsible for this and this. And apparently it comes out in jealousy of my dog.
That's all of us.
Yeah, I think that's kind of fair though. But you're right. Practicing mindfulness is a lot harder than it sounds. It's one of the components of what we do at my job at Middle Path is teaching people how to be mindful, how to do that. And there's a lot of different ways. And a lot of it's about finding what is effective for you and what isn't. I tend to give the example of meditation. I'm a hot mess at meditating. It is... It is not a pretty picture. I've had done trainings on it. I've practiced it in multiple ways. And actually, when I first started working there, and there was a practitioner coming in to lead a mindful meditation group, I was like, how can I skip that? How can I get out on that? Like, I really, that's not my thing. I don't really want to do that. But I made myself go and I made myself try it. And I actually learned there are a lot of different forms of meditation. There are a lot of different ways to do it, not just let me sit here and breathe and only focus on my breath and do nothing but think about my breath and, shun all other thoughts. It never worked. I never could do it because I got a billion things going on in my head. And so it's kind of just finding what works, but it's a hard thing to do, but that being able to do that and get in that present moment is really, really crucial for someone trying to come out of that distress state, that crisis place.
So if I could put on sort of my more cynical hat, like I could hear someone saying, especially from a Christian perspective, saying, oh, mindfulness, that's a bunch of psychobabble. They just need to pray. I just kind of want to say meditation has been a form of Christian prayer for like 2000 years now.
Absolutely.
And we do lose sight of that. And, Absolutely. So those two ideas, meditation and prayer, church history, biblically speaking, they're not mutually exclusive. There's a tremendous amount of overlap, and prayer is very much a form of meditation. And so just in case people have little warnings popping up, there's like, what is this mindfulness stuff? I have time with Jesus. I would say time with Jesus is a really helpful way to be mindful, to be aware. And to, again, what you're trying to do, I mean, I'm no expert or anything approaching it, but a lot of mindfulness is, well, let's be aware of our surroundings. Let's really understand what's happening. Let's sort of tune into what's happening in our bodies. All of those are prayer practices and can be exclusively a prayer practice. Like people who would never use the word meditation or mindfulness, but they have a very intentional prayer life where they walk in real intimacy with Jesus. I would say, yeah, you don't need to learn those words or those practices, because you've already found it naturally in just your life with the Lord.
Correct.
Exactly. Yeah.
And so they're not mutually exclusive. And they don't need to be pitted against one another either. That's, I think.
And it's terminology. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. Prayer is absolutely meditation, and meditation, I absolutely agree with that. It's just really what's meeting your need and where you're at.
I lean heavy on, in our previous podcast, we had talked a little bit about, the integrated wellness and the purpose behind that of being mind, body, and spirit. You know, trauma work requires levels of spirituality mm-hmm. as part of that process of being able to self-regulate, you know, knowing that you're in the present moment, knowing that you're not alone. Mm-hmm. You know, and that spirituality can look different, you know, for different people. Mm-hmm. You know, as a therapist, we don't want to judge that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's the time that we do bring in our faith. You know, mm-hmm. God is walking with you. Mm-hmm. Whoever you identify as your higher power is going to walk with you mm-hmm. through this journey. And that often brings a lot of comfort mm-hmm. to bring that into practice. Mm-hmm. So, yes, prayer, meditation, that goes hand in hand.
So what about this? If there's someone, maybe they're hearing this and they're saying, you know what, I do kind of get stuck in that, you know, hypervigilant state, or I get stuck in places of deep stress or anxiety or panic, things like that. And I have a hard time regulating, getting back to the normative state. And to that, we're saying, hey, you could really benefit from therapy. Mm-hmm. This might make you both cringe just a little bit, but there are some people who they're mm-hmm. just not going to do it.
Correct.
They're going to
yep.
say,
yep.
I have my own ways, or I have better ideas, or I have really strong feelings about that. Or my parents went to a therapist and they were divorced 3 months later. And I blame, you know, there's lots of reasons, mm-hmm. valid or not. Some people go, finances are an enormous barrier mm-hmm. and integrated wellness and our church and others have helped to try to solve that, but a gap still remains. There are other people who they're just not, for whatever reason. Are there other things, especially if someone, let's say they're having these sort of trauma-informed responses mm-hmm. based on some of the stuff we've described, where they're, you know, again, they're getting stuck in places of panic, and they're, you know, what are some of the valid things that they could do to help them learn how to regulate on their own in the event that they're just like, yeah, I'm not going to go see a therapist for whatever reason.
Well, let's get out our list. The long list.
Long list.
So, identifying your triggers in your environment mm-hmm. is a big one. So if you are anxious and you're listening to the news, if you're listening to,
on social media.
Mm-hmm. Social media, yeah. I'm trying to think of like a big rock band name and it's not coming to mind, but
Metallica.
Do what?
Metallica.
Yeah. If you're listening to these things, you know, and they're in your environment, they will absolutely play into trauma response, just general anxiety. So being aware of what's happening mm-hmm. in your environment, taking care of your yeah. body, getting enough sleep, mm-hmm. coming to, you know, identifying a routine for yourself. Mm-hmm. I feel like I'm talking too much. Lauren,
You're hitting on a lot of it. And I'm thinking through, we do a model called DBT at Mental Path. And, you know, it touches on a lot of the skills that we teach. One of them is, have I eaten today? Uh-huh. Am I hydrated? How much sleep did I get? Looking at some mm-hmm. basic things that can help check like physically where you're at and mm-hmm. can also lower where you are, you know, your heart rate. How much caffeine have you had? Are we on the third 2 liter of Mountain Dew? I'm not judging. My husband is a chronic diet Mountain Dew drinker, mm-hmm. but there's a lot of caffeine in there. Yeah. And if you're already amped up, you're just continuing that process and making it worse. So there are some very small, simple day-to-day things that you can do.
Not to get too down in the weeds, but like if you feel yourself dealing with a lot of stress and anxiety, then like you should limit your caffeine intake. Like that's right, isn't it?
You should. I mean, yes, yeah. You should.
Mm-hmm. You can have
easier said than done.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And those, you know, when you were listing that, it made me think of a couple of acronyms. In 12-step process, they talk about HALT, mm-hmm. hungry, angry, lonely, tired.
Correct.
Like, and to me, that's getting in your time machine and going, okay, am I hungry? Am I angry? Am I lonely? And sometimes I'm like, I'm 4 for 4. Yeah. And then my this is a silly thing that I made up one day. Just in general, it's a broad category. When I'm not doing well, my little acronym is I need to get sped up, which involves a lot of slowing down. But it's a forced acronym. I'm a preacher. I think like this: sleep, prayer, mm-hmm. exercise, diet. So and I have to go sleep first. I literally can't even pray if I'm sleep deprived. Mm-hmm. So it's for me, it's sequential. And this is where I've sort of worked it out. Okay, this is what helps me get sort of my feet back underneath me. Mm-hmm. A healthy sleep pattern, prayer, exercise, and then diet. For me, it goes exercise and diet because if I exercise, I'm more motivated to diet. And for some mm-hmm. people, if they're diet, they're more motivated to, mm-hmm. to exercise. But like sort of intentionally finding, okay, what actually works for me to help me get regulated, mm-hmm. to, for lack of a better word.
Yep. And then I would add to that too, check in with your breathing. You know, we had talked about, mm-hmm. the mindfulness, mm-hmm. stuff, and really that all goes back to the breath. Yep. I was working with a law enforcement officer, you know, who was not really, he wasn't buying into the whole DBT stuff. But what he found to work for him was getting in his car. And every day, mm-hmm. when he would get in his car before he would, you know, start his shift, he would put his hands on the steering wheel and take a deep breath in through his nose, mm-hmm. and out through his mouth, and just allow himself to be in that moment and notice what it feels like to sit, mm-hmm. in his car. Mm-hmm. And then he was ready for the day. Mm-hmm. So just being able to recognize what it feels like to breathe, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. and that's going to bring you out of that out of the sympathetic into the parasympathetic, mm-hmm. where you can regulate.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Remember after, I mentioned earlier, I had a couple years where life was just brutal. Mm-hmm. And one of the things where one of the things that helped me wake up to realize, oh, I'm actually in a really tough spot, is I'd had so many pieces of bad news come by way of text message, that every time I looked down at my phone because I'd gotten a notification of a new text message, my body was reacting to it. Mm-hmm. My heart would drop. My pulse would elevate. I was like, I'm like legitimately triggered by a text message. And how many of those do we get a day? Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. and most of them are neutral or great, yeah. but you get enough times where a text message brings something really difficult. Then suddenly you're reacting to something as normal as a text message in a way that puts you in this, in a really bad, mm-hmm. frame of mind. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if people are saying, okay, if I or someone I love needs to get some help, What should I look for? What should I be looking for in a spouse who I think is needing to get help managing stress, anxiety, or some of the trauma that is affecting, mm-hmm. the way that they live their lives? Are there any things in particular that they could be looking for?
Lack of sleep, poor appetite, not being able to focus. Mm-hmm.
Irritability,
losing, mm-hmm. things, you know, forgetfulness. Mm-hmm. Gosh, there's kind of like a laundry list, but those are maybe like the main ones.
Kind of the most obvious things, yeah, that the kind of in your face stuff, like this is just not how they normally roll. This, mm-hmm. isn't.
So just change and.
When one of these things impacts your ability to function on a regular basis, you know, that's what I always go back to. When you're starting to have symptoms that are impeding your ability to function, mm-hmm. like daily living activities, showering, mm-hmm. eating, sleeping, having conversations with loved ones, mm-hmm. going out with friends, when you are unable to do those things because of something that, mm-hmm. is happening, whether it be like the depressive symptoms or anxiety symptoms, those are all red flags for, mm-hmm. you know, maybe it's time to reach out for some help.
And I, yeah. think it goes back to one of your initial questions, is it's more than just a bad day. It's more than just this one day I'm not feeling it. Mm-hmm. I'm not feeling like socializing. It's I'm noticing a pattern start to happen. I'm noticing this is happening more and more, and you're disengaging from life, mm. more and more.
Yeah. It's interesting. Yeah, it was reminding me of something I did. There's I'm trying to decide if I should give this illustration, but I will. It's fine. on a mixing board for like a soundboard like we have in the sanctuary, mm-hmm. There's a thing called compression. And compression, basically think of the sound going through a tube, and it cuts off the highest peaks, and it cuts out the lowest peaks. So it sort of keeps you in the middle from sort of the spectrum of sound. The high peaks are the really loud stuff, through the quiet, mm-hmm. stuff, the really screechy stuff. It all gets cut out because compression, mm-hmm. limits how much will happen in that spectrum. And I realize I very much have a compression knob. I determine how emotionally available or unavailable I'm going to be based on what is required of me in the moment. Okay. So like I spend I'm about to go do a funeral. What do I need to do? How can I regulate so that I can be emotionally available to the people I'm talking to? And not lose it while, mm-hmm. I'm trying to be hopefully a source of comfort. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I noticed, again, going back to the rough spot going back a few years ago, is my capacity to do that like I kept turning up the compression, turning it up and up and up and up, and limiting the emotional range, what I was experiencing more and more and more. And then one day the knob just broke, and my capacity to regulate out and cut out those emotional highs and lows was just gone. It was just gone. And I became a much more open and honest and vulnerable person. And I also became like a way less regulated person for a while, like for quite a while, actually. It took me a long time to sort of move out of that because I was using that compression too much. It became my coping mechanism to the point that I broke it, and the capacity to do it was gone. It took me a while to bounce back from that.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you kind of identify too, like it took you a while to bounce back, but you know, we don't always recognize when we're in that place. It may take having a loved one, you know, tell you like, hey, something's going up. On here. Like, let's talk about it. So I think, you know, identifying communication is a huge part of all of this, and not to fear that kind of communication. You know, if somebody is saying that to you, they're probably coming from a place of love, not from a place of shame. So kind of going into that place of like normalizing, you know, this can happen to any of us, and it happens to all of us.
Yeah. And it's really helpful if you, I'm glad you said that, because it takes a matter. It takes a lot of courage to say to someone, hey, I'm concerned about you for these reasons. That person is taking a risk of upsetting you, of hurting you. If they didn't love you, they wouldn't be bringing it up in the first place. So that means they value your relationship. So they're taking a real risk to say, hey, I'm concerned, and this is why. And maybe they're right, and maybe they're wrong, but we need to go all that we can to be gracious and see that exclusively as an act of kindness.
Yes.
And not an attack.
Yes.
When someone says, hey, I'm concerned, I think you might benefit from, you know, this, that, or the other thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I like it. I think we've sort of covered the bases here. And like we said earlier, it's such an incredibly broad topic. But let's shift and talk specifically about our faith and trauma. I've been talking to mental health professionals. I've been trying to use your language, which I don't know. but the fact is, the fact that we have life with Jesus, the fact that we have security in our ultimate destiny is incredibly helpful in trying to deal with the inevitably traumatic things that hit us in this life. So how would you say, Stacia, our faith in Jesus can impact the way that we respond to trauma, or even how we might have hope to heal?
Yeah. So going back to, you know, when we were talking about learning those regulation skills, you know, when we're in that place of crisis and we're not able to think or process those bigger things, how we regulate ourselves is to calm our system down by recognizing that we are safe and that we are loved. So I had shared, you know, in my office, that's where I will go with clients, is recognizing you are in my office right now. We have this relationship. You are safe. You are loved. You are not alone. And that is often where I will bring in spirituality, because if we can identify that Jesus is walking with you, you aren't alone through this process, even if it feels like you are, you really aren't. That's so beneficial to clients.
Well, I'm sure you are. I mean, I know for a fact, actually, that your services are available to anyone in any walk or stage of life. But I would imagine if someone reveals to you, hey, I'm a Christ follower, then you must think, okay, well, there's this whole language that's available to us now that wouldn't be available otherwise. That's not to say that people without Jesus can't find meaningful healing or make meaningful progress at all, but suddenly it's like there's a lot more tools available to you as far as how you might be able to help this person.
It's very difficult. Very difficult. So yes, encouraging, finding their spirituality is, once again, a huge part of it.
And you were talking about helping people recognize that they are okay and they are loved. So that can happen in therapy, obviously. But that should be happening to some degree all the time in any kind of a healthy community, mm-hmm. right? So if we gather for worship, or if you just gather for prayer with anybody, a small group, mm-hmm. With your family, your kids, your spouse, if that's your story, whatever, you should be in a Christian community that is marked by the way of Jesus in a meaningful way. You shouldn't be able to gather and not be told you are safe and you are loved in lots of different ways, because it's so fundamental to the core of our faith and mm-hmm. the message of Jesus.
Yep. Encouraging that community is a huge mm-hmm. part of it as well.
Yeah. And being willing to reach out to others. And, you know, this is somewhat coming from a personal experience, but, you know, it can be hard to be that person that's like, I'm going to go and introduce myself to this new group in this new place that I'm in, and mm-hmm. maybe being that person, like, I am established. Let me invite that person. Let me step out, because then that makes them more comfortable mm-hmm. to be willing to join the small group, or to mm-hmm. be willing to do something more. And it helps them feel like what they're maybe hearing in other places, that you are loved and you are wanted and you are cared for. Here's just this random person that's given me that example too. Mm-hmm. And maybe they have that established mindset that people don't care and I'm not wanted and I'm not loved. Mm-hmm. And here's just this example that came out of nowhere that I'm not used to getting. And so it starts to build a new reference point mm-hmm. for them.
A new neural network mm-hmm. in your brain. Uh-huh. It really does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what would you say to someone, and it would take some self-aware to notice this, some self-awareness, but people would say, I'm struggling on, you know, a number of levels, or I'm dealing with depression or intense anxiety. Social settings tend to, or can for some people, trigger those things all the more. And I think people really do have a tendency to isolate mm-hmm. and pull themselves away from community. And yet a healthy community where you know that you're safe and you are loved is like at the core of what's needed.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So what might people need to look for to be honest, to see, am I starting to do that? Am I starting to isolate? Mm-hmm. And then what would you say to them to try to encourage them to take the risk and show up and be present in a place?
For me, I think part of it's just being noticed. I mean, that goes a long mm-hmm. way, that I noticed you weren't there, or I noticed like you didn't show up, but I'm used to seeing you, even if you have maybe been more in the corner. Uh-huh. But I think it's important to have that little bit of courage to maybe find somebody to say, you know, I'm not feeling connected. I'm not mm-hmm. feeling like this is maybe the place for me, or, if you have that, if you're maybe not that isolated yet to mm-hmm. where you can say that. But I feel like within the Christian community and just feeling like I am in a church, or I'm in an environment that is about what it's supposed to be, mm-hmm. about that community and that involvement, somebody's going to notice mm-hmm. that you're not there. Mm-hmm. And maybe you're that person that notices.
Yeah.
And that can be really powerful, that mm-hmm. in that sea of people, you're the one that noticed that this person is slowly disengaging mm-hmm. or hasn't shown up. And that can be very, very powerful to get mm-hmm. that phone call or... Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. To the person who is, you know, starting to disengage or notice that they're disengaging, I am actually, you know, grateful for COVID for one thing. Hmm. It has broadened our ability to meet virtually for virtual groups. That has been, mm-hmm. you know, such a blessing for people in 12-step programs, you know, especially across the board, having that access 24/7, finding groups. You know, I know you guys do some virtual groups as well. Mm-hmm. And we have, you know, our church that is also, you know, the services are online, like mm-hmm. being able to connect if we're too nervous to go out, or too, you know, whatever the symptoms are. That was just mm-hmm. a symptom I identified. But if we're unable to leave our house because of the symptoms, at least starting with maybe connecting virtually mm-hmm. and maintaining some sort of connection. You know, yeah. Lauren was talking mm-hmm. about like phone calls and things like that.
There are a ton of options now, way more yeah. than pre-COVID.
And I always say, taking baby steps and be mm-hmm. patient with yourself. Mm-hmm. You know, don't yeah. try to tackle mm-hmm. it all at once. There's this other hype that I hear about, you know, this exposure therapy of like, we're just going to bring them to church and put them in the center, you know, and throw them into the wolves. Yeah. And it's like, no, that mm-hmm. is because mm-hmm. we can't do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Baby steps.
Add to the list of traumatic experiences. Yep. Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Baby steps. So when patient
never
with
come
yourself.
Back again, do
yeah.
that.
Yeah. But on the other hand, though, I'm so strongly agreeing that that would be a horrible idea. But on the, at the other hand, if someone is thinking, you know, there are a lot of people dealing with trauma, they need to be told that they're safe and that they're loved. I'm not a therapist. I can't do mm-hmm. what Stacia does. I can't do what Lauren does. But if at the really at the core is letting people know that they're loved, like saying hello to someone on a Sunday morning and greeting them warmly, and even not just on Sunday mornings. These are sacred gatherings when we gather, so I think that's a force multiplier because we gathered in the Lord's presence. But at Kroger or fill in the blank, just mm-hmm. being welcoming and kind and engaging doesn't make you a therapist, but you are doing something mm-hmm. therapeutic. Absolutely. And potentially something really healing. And like, it matters significantly. And we can go, those are tiny little things. But we mm-hmm. talk about micro traumas.
Yep.
But you can also have like micro healings. And mm-hmm. sometimes just being warm and kind and smiling and saying, I'm glad that you're here. Or, I'm glad I bumped into you. Or it's so nice to see you. Mm-hmm. That's a micro healing. It's a micro therapy in a way if people are also yep. getting hit with micro traumas.
Yeah, I love it. You are totally correct.
And any sort of gathering for worship is just we're setting the stage for that in mm-hmm. really meaningful ways. So one last idea here. You guys, you're both part of our church. Joining God in the renewal of all things is our mission statement. And part of what I love so much about that is it's an overarching story that says you're not an accident. You have a place in the world. God is renewing mm-hmm. all things. You have a place and a purpose in it. And I think as you're dealing with trauma, maybe you can correct this, but maybe your view of the world gets smaller and smaller. You get hyper focused mm-hmm. on whatever that difficulty is, and you can lose sight of a larger place mm-hmm. and the bigger picture. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to take a minute, man. If you're dealing with trauma, if you're feeling like stress or anxiety are starting to take over, I would encourage you, as we already said, don't isolate. Mm-hmm. Take the baby steps. And if you're willing, get help. Mm-hmm. But then one of the things I want to just frame up for you is we have a purpose and a place and a mission. God is renewing all things. Mm-hmm. And we have a place in a larger story, the ultimate story, to join God in the renewal of all things. Mm-hmm. So I guess there's actually not a question in that.
No, but that was beautiful.
I ended up giving a sermonette.
Like it.
Sorry.
That's exactly where I needed to go. Mm-hmm.
Good. Did we hit all the high points? You guys know. Is there anything else you feel like we need to hit if we're like, oh man, we missed it if we didn't discuss it?
I think you did. I mean,
yeah, I think we kind of covered everything. Of course, we can go into
willing to ask for help. Mm-hmm. I mean, and I'm sure Stacia's the same way. You know, I'm happy to answer questions. If you don't know where to start, you know, grab mm-hmm. somebody, ask. Aaron, mm-hmm. I have no doubt, would be happy mm-hmm. to like steer you towards someone. But
yes.
Ask somebody and ask somebody that maybe can at least guide you to someone who will know.
Yes.
The answer.
That's great.
Or get you to that answer. Mm-hmm. So not trying to go back on my social media soapbox, but make it, you know,
ahead.
Make your question to somebody that can give you a helpful answer,
yeah.
you know, or help Absolutely. You find that helpful answer, yeah. I guess is more what I want to say.
We can do something more helpful in our context than just, hey, go Google that.
Right.
Because there actually are a disproportionate amount of mental health professionals within the life of our church. It's part of the reason why we're doing this series, because we have access to people with a lot of expertise across a variety of fields. And so you mm-hmm. may not know who Lauren or Stacia are, but if you're in our church, there's a good chance you know who I am. Mm-hmm. And I would be happy to introduce you to one of these folks or one of a whole bunch of others that mm-hmm. are in our church. Who can help you, you know, within you know, through Christian lenses as well, say, here might be some helpful steps. Mm-hmm. Maybe you could benefit from some therapy, and here's some places you could look for that and help kind of refer people along. We have a list of folks we refer people to, mm-hmm. as well. We're helpful. We're happy to help people find a spot.
Right.
To get some help. And people will often ask me questions like, do I need therapy, or do I just need prayer, or do I just need to read the Bible? My answer is almost always yes. Just
mm-hmm. all of
yes
it.
To all of all the above.
All of it.
They're not at odds with one another. They're not mm-hmm. mutually exclusive or anything like that. Okay, well, thank you so much for taking time and sharing your expertise and digging into this stuff with us.
Fun.
It's really helpful. Well, God bless you. Thanks so much. Appreciate it.